Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Claudio Tenia. He is a tenured research group leader in the Department of Early Prehistory and Quaternary Ecology at the University of Tübingen. His main research triangulates what makes human cognition unique, as well as why. In particularly, he uses various methods and pathways to study the factors and the prehistorical beginnings that enable the typical modern human variant of culture, cumulative culture of know-how. And today we're going to talk about that and specifically about tool use and tool behavior. So, Dr. Tenia, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So let's start perhaps with other primates before we get into humans. Do we find tool behaviors in other primates, and what can we learn from them about early humans?
This is great. Yes. So I am now essentially in an archaeological department, right? And it was interestingly historically the case that it was especially the archaeologists via Leakey who were and who become interested in great ape tool use, other great apes than us. And so I'm in a good position right now to combine all these different threads, as it were. And what was found then via Jane Goodall and others is that other apes do indeed use tools too. And this has been a source of fascination ever since. And the question then becomes, and became already back then, well, what does that mean for the understanding of our prehistory? What does it mean for the understanding of the evolution of tools and culture in our own species?
And I mean, what do we know about other species? What other species of great apes use tools, and what kinds of tools?
There was actually a great variety. So in the beginning, it was just a couple of tool use that were found, but by now we know an awful lot about tool use, not only in other apes, but also in monkeys. Just the other week, it was found that, for example, crested capuchin monkeys show a diverse set of tool use too. But what we find in the great apes is that among the great apes in the wild, most tool use is being shown by chimpanzees and by orangutans. But occasionally, you also find it in bonobos and gorillas. Now, when we go to captivity, the picture changes somewhat, namely in the way that now the gorillas and bonobos also can show a lot of tool use when they are sufficiently motivated, I want to say.
So we have, for example, flaked stone tools in orangutans and chimpanzees, right?
So we recently tested these flake production and flake use in orangutans and chimpanzees. That's true. I should explain a little bit what these tools are. So when we go in prehistory, when we look at the evolution of tools in our own lineage, what we find is we find a certain type of stone tool. I want to call it here sharp stone tools. And the sharpness of these stone tools was very likely what the hominins, that is the makers, our direct ancestors back in a long time ago, were after. So they were trying to make sharp stone tools in order to use their sharpness as tools. Now, a lot has been said and written about the significance of this, right? The idea was for a long time that this was a significant event in our prehistory. This was a Rubicon that we traversed, and that in some ways it marked us as becoming humans for some people. You know, this was the idea. But if that were true, then other species shouldn't be able to make and use these stone tools. If that really were such a significant event that marks us, our lineage, as special and separate from other species. And here we entered the conundrum, because before we tested the apes for the production and use of these sharp stone tools, the only studies available were studies on one orangutan and a couple of bonobos. But these were, in all these cases, trained in producing these behaviors and or indirectly trained to become humans or human-like, namely via what is called enculturation. And so the data that derived from these studies could not be taken as at face value. We needed to redo these studies, and we recently did. And what we found is that the orangutans made sharp stone tools and also used sharp stone tools, but only in the latter case if these sharp stone tools were produced by humans first. So that's maybe the short answer here. So, okay, to wrap it all up, I should say that this shows as proof of principle that no, this kind of behavior of making and using sharp stone tools was not a Rubicon in this particular sense. I'm not saying this is not a cool behavior, it is, but it's not a behavior that only hominins could have produced, you know? It shows that also other species can do so. And actually in the 90s, there were also some more studies that showed the same thing in capuchin monkeys. Not as directly related to us as the apes, but also of high relevance as a proof of principle.
And you've also studied food cleaning in gorillas, correct?
Yes, so food cleaning is an interesting behavior because it's not in that sense a tool use behavior because you use your own body in these cases to clean food. You remove dirt, you remove spines, you know, this kind of thing, and you use your body. For example, a gorilla might take in our study, a dirty apple and then rub it on their forearm to remove the dirt. So they often did that. So what this leads over is the general question of where behavior, and I'm guessing you're getting to that, where the general behavior comes from. It's not just related to tool use. Many people are very focused on tool use, you know, and again, it's a very cool category of behavior. But the major underlying question in all of these cases can be, well, but where does the behavior come from? And this question is then a similar question for whether it is about foraging behavior, like this food cleaning, or whether it's about tool use behavior, whether it's about social behavior, etc. Right? So that kind of question can be asked in all of these cases.
Okay, so before we move on to the next topic, let me just ask you. So by studying these tool behaviors in other great apes, what can we learn about early tool behaviors in humans or hominins, sorry.
Yes, the hominins. So just a quick definition here. So hominins are all the species that belong on our tree of the family, right? So the last common ancestor of apes and humans was something else then, right? But everything that followed from there on our part of the tree, you will know this just for your listeners, is then a hominin by definition, you know? So these are, shortcut would be to simply say our ancestors. Now, what we want to find out is, you know, as a general idea, we want to find out what made these hominins tick, right? What explains their behavior, what explains their cognition, etc. And we use different methods to try to do so. We can have general inferences from general biology, right? And then maybe there it doesn't matter so much which species you're studying. For example, we can infer that they breathed, right? So that's very clear that they did these kind of general behaviors. But when we want to understand other behaviors and especially also limitations to their behaviors, then one very important method is to use phylogenetic inference. So for example, this may sound a bit crazy, but for example, if we want to check whether hominins flew, whether they were flying, you know, well, you know, we see that none of the other primates are flying, including us, right? I mean, if we fly, we use tools that we culturally developed. So we can infer that they didn't fly, right? But we can use other methods too. We can look at their anatomy because we find fossils. And there again, we would see that they don't fly. Again, this sounds a bit crazy, but I think this flying example might come in handy later on in the interview. Yes.
Okay, so another thing that you've studied is chimpanzees in captivity, particularly their problem-solving capacity. So, what influences their problem-solving in this context? Because I guess that it's different from studying them in the wild, for example.
Well, that is the question. You know, one of the million-dollar questions is it different from the wild, right? And we have now a couple of pointers in that direction. We know that, and luckily, basically nobody is doing that anymore, you know, for ethical reasons. But if you were to raise a chimpanzee directly after birth with no social contact at all, and so on and so forth, right, you deprive them. And under these circumstances, it is very likely that they will not show a super wide range of behaviors. They will be deprived, you know, and it's a horrible thing to do. So, but then on the other extreme, you might pick them up from directly after birth, and then you integrate them in human societies. You try to raise them as you would your own children. Now, Kellogg's and Kellogg's did that way back, and they tried to basically raise a chimpanzee just like a human in their family. Now, what happened in these cases was that chimpanzee didn't really turn human, but the other kid, the human kid, turned a bit chimpanzee, you know. So this is a very famous story there. However, yes, this particular experiment, also horrible in many ways, failed to produce a new human from a chimpanzee base, as it were. That's true. But we know that human raising and human training, and this can be really often done unintentionally if you have got very close contact with these animals, changes them to some degree, right? So this is then what is known as enculturation. So we have therefore now a new category. So we've got the super extreme of a super deprived subject, horrible. The super extreme of trying to make a new human, you know, also horrible, you know. But then we have got something in between that is closer to this trying to make them completely human, which is enculturation. But now we have got this empty circle here, and that would be where you raise them in captivity, yes, but you are trying to let them be raised by themselves. So you are trying to have a social community, say, of chimpanzees. And they are living with each other, they're interacting with each other, and so on. And you try, as a human, you try to stay back as much as possible. Now, this is the approach that has been taken by most modern zoos, by most sanctuaries also. And it is basically within this category that I'm and my research group are trying to do our studies in. And there, now that we have got these four categories, there, it's actually not that certain to say that this particular category of apes, unenculturated, untrained captive apes, may not be completely the same or very much the same as wild apes are. You should not forget also that in the wild, there is a wide variety of social situations as well. Some can be also quite horrible, especially these days with shrinking environments and so on, hunting, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a variety in captivity and there is a variety also in the wild. And I personally have been saying in print, for example, with Joe Henrich in the book chapter, that these unenculturated, untrained, but socially raised and living chimpanzees are quite representative of their wild counterparts, right? So in that sense, I would reject the notion, I'm sorry, I would reject the notion that these captive apes have to be different, you know? No, we are honing in on the seeming fact that they are not all that different, you know? And part of the reason why we believe that is that if you then test them with some material or situations like those faced by wild chimpanzees, they behave in very similar ways. So if they really were all that different, well, then they would be showing different behaviors, wouldn't they, right? And so this is another way of checking the relevance and the validity of this particular subcategory of apes, you know. So we really focus on these apes. I personally wouldn't like to study deprived apes, you know, again, ethical reasons as well. These human-raised ones, I also wouldn't like to study them so much. I'm not saying that scientifically speaking, and leaving the ethics aside, you know, that these results are uninteresting. I wouldn't say that, right? But I personally wouldn't like to be involved. And for the kind of questions that I myself are asking, and my research group that we are asking, we need to and we must concentrate on the unenculturated, untrained apes.
And what are the psychological mechanisms that underlie the acquisition of tool behaviors?
So that depends. You see, for example, there are some nice papers showing that certain species of spiders also use tools, right? And they use, in this particular case, they use stone tools, tiny little stones, you know, which they use as basically extended sensory tools. When somebody stumbles or something stumbles across these stones, you know, the spiders will notice it. So they do use stones as tools. Not only does this show that stone tool use per se is nothing super special, you know, but it also shows that these spiders can do these kind of things more or less without requiring all of this cultural baggage that we humans are using. They are just doing this. Now, in the old days, one would have called that an instinctive behavior. People now went away from the use of the term instinctive because actually the way that people think about instincts doesn't really work in the vast majority of cases, including in these spiders. So that term doesn't really work. So a different framework, I think, is much easier to transmit and also much more precise in many ways. So we can imagine that behavioral forms, including tool use behaviors, can come about via different sources, right? Via different evolutionary sources. Now, in humans, a big source is cultural transmission, right? So let's imagine culture being this kind of thing here at the top. Now, in some other animals, the genetic predispositions and so on play a very large factor too. So now we have got this line already between culture and genes. But there's a third thing that makes it now a two-dimensional space, a pyramid, if you so want, right? Or a triangle, rather. And that is the environment. Because the environment can also prescribe behaviors in several ways too. For example, these spiders wouldn't be able to use stones if they wouldn't be in their environment, right? For example, right? So they inherit not just their genes, they also inherit stones, right? It sounds a bit strange, but that is what is happening. So we have got this triangle here of genes, environment, and culture. And with this framework, I think I can do a better job at answering your question here. Now I can say, where does this tool behavior come from? Well, it depends which species, but also which developmental step you're looking at. In the spiders, I would presume you would need to study it, of course, you know, but my hypothesis would be the genetic axis plays a large role and the environment to some degree too. For example, they need these stones in their environment. Now, when we look at, for example, humans, again, I mentioned this before, right? When we are adult and we are learning some new adult, super complicated things, you know, I think the cultural axis is very heavily involved here. And our genetic axis is not so much involved here. And even the environment is quite cultural by this point too. So it really depends when you're looking at an animal or a human, and also what behavior you're looking at and what species you're looking at, right? So it can come from different sources. But what we find in the ape case is that this cultural axis is not that important, or not nearly as important as most people believe that it is. And this is a big surprise. And I should say here, it was a big surprise to me too. When I came to this topic, I believed, just like everybody else, I believed that apes ape, You know, that is the saying in many languages. I believe that they, when they are doing things, that they are not only learning this from each other, but that they have to learn it from each other, right? So it was a big surprise to find that that is empirically simply not the case, right? A big shock. It was a shock for me, and whenever I give a talk and so on, it's shocking for people to hear. But the data is very, very strong on that.
Can children spontaneously invent tool-use behaviors? Is that possible?
Children can, yes, we have tested that. We have, so in normally in our developmental psychology, I lingered in developmental psychology for a while too. So I'm a biologist by training, then I did developmental comparative psychology, and now I'm an archaeologist. So when I did these developmental studies still in humans, I thought it would be good, and we did this with Eva Reindl at the time, PhD student of mine, great PhD student. We did this study where we thought we're going to reverse the logic. Instead of taking some animal-inspired tasks and presenting them to a human, no. Instead of taking some human-inspired task and presenting them to animals, that is what usually has been happening in comparative cognition, we did the opposite. We took animal-inspired tasks, we took tasks, behaviors, tool behaviors from apes in the wild, and then we transferred that into situations that we could recreate in the laboratory, and we presented these situations to human children, you know? And these human children then, and we did not show them how, you know, the tool use works in each of these cases. And what we found is that the kids were, by and large, very able to spontaneously re-innovate the tool use behavior of these wild apes, right? So we have therefore done like the missing puzzle, as it were. Beforehand, it was found that when we have some human-inspired tasks, apes can often solve them, not always, but can often solve them. But now we could show, well, the same is also true of human children, right? When we take some tool behavior from the wild, from apes, human children can do that too. And this comes back to the triangle that we have been talking about earlier. It depends when you're looking at a species. So when we test young children who haven't been so heavily enculturated, we humans are enculturated too, who haven't been so heavily enculturated and who haven't yet have soaked up so much culture before, you essentially place the human species then, when you look at this developmental stage, this is a little bit glossing over some details, but I think it can stand like I'm going to say it. You can place them more into a, like an ape-like state where the cultural axis doesn't play so much of a role anymore. So now what plays more of a role would be these genetic environmental interaction axis, right? So where you have to individually, as a species, where you have to individually develop certain behaviors. In this particular case, tool behaviors, but I'm certain there are also other behaviors, social behaviors, and so on. And some people are working on that too. I know that. I think Kat Hobiter in St. Andrews is working on this kind of studies, the social behavior renovation, as it were, in the human species. So when we look at human children, depending on their age and so on, depending on their background, it can totally be that they individually innovate some things, right? So they have got a range of behavior, including tool behavior. It's a range that they don't actually need others to copy from. And just to finish up on that, there is in developmental psychology, there is this horrible dream of developmental psychologists, not that they are going to do it, but you know, as a thought experiment, they often invoke it to take a bunch of kids and raise them on an island alone, you know, in the absence of cultural influences. And people have given different kinds of answers as to what would happen, right? Typically, people then ask, would they have language, this and that? But our study suggests that these children then would be eventually would be developing many of the tool behaviors that we see in other apes, right? So that's one answer, part of the answer of how these children would behave on that island.
Are there cultural behaviors that do not necessitate cultural transmission for individuals to exhibit them? And could you give us some examples of that?
So yeah, a good example would be very likely these tool behaviors that are shown by these children, right? It is unlikely that all of these children that innovated these tool behaviors had been shown or even trained in all of these tool behaviors by these apes before, right? It's far more likely that really they innovated these tool behaviors, or at least most of these tool behaviors. So that would be then behavior forms, know-how, if you so want, right? We like to talk about know-how that can be reinnovated on the spot. But then the question becomes, should we call them cultural behaviors at all? Because we call them cultural behaviors, right? So maybe it's better or more precise to simply ask, can there be behavioral forms? Can there be know-how that can come about spontaneously, right? And you don't actually need this cumulative cultural transmission or cultural access more generally from others to show it. And this is indeed at the heart of my research group's questions. We want to find out what are, one current question, for example, is what is the first type of know-how in our lineage in hominins that really required cultural transmission from others, you know, because we find that so many others don't. We talked about the flaking behavior before, the production of like the earliest types of sharp stone tools. Doesn't seem to require cultural transmission. Proof of principle for that is the study on the orangutans that we did, but we also have recently shown it in humans, but maybe we get to that.
But okay, so is cultural or human cognition really unique?
Well, yes and no, right? Uniqueness is a tricky concept. You can, if you look at different species, right, kind of by definition, each species is unique in some ways, otherwise it wouldn't be a species, right? So the uniqueness thing is a two-sided sword, or even maybe even has more sides to it. But what seems to be unique is the extent to which the human species depends on culture. That's the extent to which we depend on it, but also the extent to which we have produced culture. We have become completely reliant on culture. Without culture, we die. And that is hard to be said about any other species on the planet. Maybe some arguments can be made. Some species depend, for example, not so much on know-how, but on know-where to find food or know-where to do their summer-winter transitions pathways and so on. Maybe. But the extent to which the human species are doing it is maybe unique. I want to say it's probably unique, yes. Again, the uniqueness angle is a bit dodgy because, you know, every species is unique. But because we are humans, we want to understand ourselves. And arguably, and I think the many fields have recently converged on this, right? So I'm definitely not the only one who's saying that. You know, in fact, if anything, I'm probably a latecomer to that. Many people have converged on the idea that really it's culture that is the main difference maker in the human case. Not only does culture produce all the thing that we communicate with right now, even the software that allows it, you know, not only that, but culture also made our minds, and culture even produced cultural learning. This is what Celia Hayes has been recently forcefully arguing. So culture is everywhere, and these days culture so much soaks through everything that it means to be human, that it makes it also sometimes hard to step outside of that system and even imagine that it could be different. For example, we have been saying for a while now that ape culture You could call it culture, but ape culture is very different from human culture, right? But it's very hard to see for anybody who is just, inside the human system. It is much easier to imagine that their culture is quite similar to ours, but it is not.
So talking, we've talked a little bit about the mechanisms before. What is high fidelity social learning, and do we know when it appeared in our evolutionary history?
So, yes, for a while in the field, especially of animal culture, people have been talking about high fidelity versus low fidelity social learning. And the idea was that humans use high fidelity social learning, and therefore, it would be a good quest to look for high fidelity social learning in animals too. But I think that has put this kind of research effort was, well, was produced errors. It produced errors because it put the cart before the horse. It looked at high fidelity without saying what the high fidelity is in. For example, high fidelity, low fidelity, we know these terms from music, right? So in this case, it's well defined. It's high fidelity in the kind of frequencies that are being transmitted, right? Frequencies and loudness levels. That's what defines high fidelity in music. But what are we talking about when we are talking about high fidelity in animal social learning? And so recently, together with Lydia Hopper and Karel van Schaick, we have therefore attacked this whole notion. And also, I did a later paper with Andrew Busker. We have attacked this whole notion that we should be studying high fidelity social learning if we don't define what actually the social learning is about. So what we try to highlight is that we need to define in each case what is the type of information that is being transmitted here. For example, you can have high fidelity social learning of know where. Not know how, know where. So think about honeybees, right? Now, I haven't looked into honeybees, the details about their dance with which they presumably transmit, where the good flowers are and so on and so forth. But let's assume that that data still holds, okay? Let's assume that. And then, the honeybee comes back, knows the know where the good source of nectar and so on is, and then does a little dance and transmits with relatively high fidelity the know where this food is, right? So that would be then high fidelity social learning. I wouldn't have no problem calling it that. But we need to say, in addition, high fidelity social learning of what? In this case, it would be high fidelity social learning of know where, not know how. The bees are learning how to fly on their own, right? May take them a while, but they are learning it on their own. Actually, there was a recent paper showing that in bumblebees, they also take a while in order to learn how to get pollen and nectar and so on, Yes, but they also learn this know-how on their own. So just by saying, therefore, that you have found some high fidelity social learning does not mean at all that you have found the kind of high fidelity social learning that we are really interested in humans, namely high fidelity of know how, right? So this whole high fidelity, low fidelity hunt was to a large degree a red herring that has led the field astray to a large degree, I think. It is much more productive and much more precise to say what this fidelity is for. For example, if I yawn and you start to yawn, it will look as if it's high fidelity transmission, but it is not, So we really need to be careful in looking at what is actually being transmitted here.
Talking about that, what about over-imitation? When and why do children over-imitate if they do that?
So over-imitation was a term that was used retrospectively for finding by Andy Whitten's group, And what they argued for is that human children copy all kinds of things, even if they wouldn't have to, and apes copy only what they have to. Many, many problems with the history of the term, with the data that backed up the term, but also with the interpretations. So first of all, the data back then supposedly showing that the apes are learning the know-how in this situation doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, you know? So what it looks like more likely is that they could have solved this kind of task on their own. They wouldn't have needed to actually observe others. So that's the first problem. But let's concentrate on the human children. So the term has changed a little bit over the years, what it is supposedly meaning, but partly it is meaning that human children will copy details because of social reasons. Part of the idea behind over-imitation is that. So, but if you are copying for social reasons, this is not the social learning mechanism. This is the so-called social learning bias. I compare the difference between mechanisms and biases. I like to compare it to traffic. So the social learning mechanisms transmit certain types of information. So the traffic would have a truck coming that's different from a little horse cart coming that's different from a motorcycle coming. You know, these are the different types in the metaphor, the different types of information. For example, know where, know how, you know. But then the social learning biases are not different things on the street. They are more the traffic lights, you know. When will these things actually move? So in over-imitation, therefore, we have the situation that people have confused the traffic lights with the traffic. So yes, you know, maybe you have social situations in which kids copy because of social reasons, but that's more a traffic light, like go, you know. But that in itself should be and has to be kept separate from what they then actually copy. So really, it all boils down still to the bigger question, the overarching question of know-how transmission, because that seems to be this really specialized human skill. Without know-how transmission, you and I wouldn't be able to speak to each other, because even to learn words, you know, you need to learn the how to pronounce them, you know, how to string together the parts in order to make a word. That's where it's at, right? So this over-imitation literature, for that reason, I think has also led the field astray to some degree. I've used the term in the past a little bit, but I regret it to some degree too. But in the study that we used it for, we found, like it's always found, that human children, when you show them something that they wouldn't do on their own, they copy it. So this is really where it's at. Human children copy know-how, even if that know-how is not something that they would do on their own. And that is, I think, the real difference to other apes. The other apes, we have tried that oftentimes in that study too, but also in other studies. You show apes something that they don't do on their own, the know-how, you know, a new behavior form. You show them something that they wouldn't do, let's say this. Right. And you reward, you know, whoever does it as well, right? So it clearly would make sense to copy that. Human children, no problem. They will copy that. Apes, again, unenculturated, untrained apes, the only relevant apes here, they will not. We tried and tested that very, very often. And so that really seems to be the difference here. Know-how copying is where it's at. Know-how copying beyond the individual, we have to be precise.
Yeah. So let's talk now about cumulative culture. What is it and how did it evolve, if we have any idea about it?
I think this is a perfect segue question here. Absolutely perfect. Because if we now imagine what cumulative culture is and has to be about, right, then it would have to be about the kind of things that we see around us and the kind of information that they're made of. Now, the main type of information that this machine that we are using right now to communicate is made of is know-how. Right? Not nowhere, you know, it's not just a stone that I found somewhere. and then the stone acts as a laptop, you know. No, it doesn't work like that. It's the know-how of putting all these things together, right? So that's the know-how, and we talked about that just in the previous question. So the cumulative culture then that really should interest us most is not so much the cumulative culture, say, of bees nowhere. You know, maybe the next bee can even more precisely tell the bees where the food is. You know, that would also be a cumulative culture of sorts, but it would be a cumulative culture of nowhere. Indeed, this was recently found in pigeons. You know, they have got a cumulative culture of nowhere too, you know, namely where to fly to. But that is cool, that's super cool, but that is not what the human culture is made of. Human cumulative culture, we have to be even more precise here, human cumulative culture is made of, in most parts or in the parts that are of main interest, of know-how. So in order to have cumulative culture of know-how, our language, this laptop, space rockets, cars, whatever, you know, just look around yourself, all of these things that you see, you know, the glass that I see there in the background of your video, you know, all of these things depend on the cultural transmission of know-how. And so I recently teamed up, like I said earlier, with Andy Buskell, and he's a philosopher, right? But he's very interested in cumulative culture too. And we have then tried to come up with a minimal definition of this kind of cumulative culture, the cumulative culture of know-how. And we basically boiled it down to the following, right? It may seem a little bit unintuitive. We said that basically the smallest part of cumulative culture of know-how is when know-how is causally transmitted. When you have know-how A, imagine a structure. This hand structure can serve as a metaphor for that structure, you know. And then you have got a copy of that that is causally linked to all the details of this structure. So you make a copy like that. It's a causal copy here, right? So the reason that this has the same form as that is not some other reason, not some genetic transmission or ecological inheritance and so on. The reason must be that this is directly linked to that. So if you have got then, in this sense, a cultural transmission of know-how, and even if in this instance the know-how did not even change, and that's the unintuitive bit, we would call that one instance, the minimal instance of cumulative culture of know-how. Now, over time, cumulative culture has a tendency to change, you know, yes, but the minimal, the gene, if you so want, of it, the minimal part that defines it is this cultural transmission, the causal transmission of the know-how itself. And that's what we are trying to find in the record. And we have been trying to find this also in the other apes. And we don't find that in the other apes, right? Instead, when we have a situation like this and then that in another apes, what we find is that the form came from other sources, right? We find that this form the apes could have produced on their own anyway, right? So that clearly shows that it is not necessary to assume that they copied this form from here to there. And we are trying to find the first evidence for that in the hominins, in our lineage.
When it comes to the mechanisms, what distinguishes really human culture from chimpanzee culture? I'm referring to chimpanzee culture here because it's probably phylogenetically the closest to ours.
It is very close, yes. And chimpanzees are the usual comparison also because we have got so many chimpanzees to work with, right? So it's to some degree also a convenience sample, right? But that also means automatically that we have got a lot of data to compare it with and so on. So I'm totally with you. Chimpanzees are the usual comparison, right? We have got good data for them. And when we do look at the chimpanzees, we find, like I was saying earlier, we find that they do not, they socially learn in many ways, right? They also learn not in the same specific way as the honeybees do, but they also learn where food is from others, for example, right? So they socially learn nowhere. They also socially learn what to interact with. So that's a know what social learning, right? But when it comes to know how social learning, at maximum, what they are doing is they are being triggered to show the same know-how as others are showing. And I'm using this word triggering. It's a nice term. It comes from Dan Sperber's work. I don't fully agree with everything that Dan Sperber has been doing and saying and so on. But in this particular instance and others, I do like what he has been saying. And it's a good metaphor. The idea that you don't actually transmit the full thing, but instead you just trigger a button, say, right? And then the full behavior springs up again in another. So that seems to be going on in the case of other apes. Why do we conclude that? Well, as I was saying earlier, if you give them some demonstrations of some know-how that no chimpanzee would spontaneously do on their own, well, then you put them in a situation where in order to make a copy of this to here, they really have to make a copy of this to here, right? Because there is no other source that can create this kind of form. And in these circumstances, they fail. Unenculturated, untrained apes, relevant apes, they fail. They will not copy this know-how. But if you give them another situation, say where one chimpanzee is termite fishing, you know, with a stick, oh, then all of a sudden the others begin to termite fish too. Yes, but it needs to be said that they would do the same if no demonstrator had been present, right? They would do it later, and not everybody would eventually converge on it, and so on, you know, because it's also then a motivational issue, et cetera, right? And maybe they find other ways to get the termites out, you know. Sure, right? But at the end of the day, they can do it on their own. It's proof of principle if one subject of a species can do it, as long as it's unenculturated by humans and untrained by humans, you know, that's proof of principle that you don't actually have to copy the know-how underlying it. That makes sense, right? So it's not the same mechanism, but it's structurally similar as this yawning example I was given earlier. You know, if the behavior form, if the know-how can come from other sources, you know, it's not a good idea to call it copy. You know, it's simply not. You know, it's a more parsimonious idea to call it, for example, triggering. In some cases, they also learn the know-how by being attracted to the know-where, where the termites are, for example, or the know-what even the termites, you know, that they are food. And then they innovate the know-how then individually on top. And that is what I was saying earlier. When I started in this business, this was a shock to me, you know, that I had to change my Bayesian priors here because I thought they are copying all this know-how from each other. That's what, you know, the BBC stories and so on television were telling you know, still are telling us. And that's also what many researchers are claiming. But the data shows it cannot be, right? If that were the case, then they shouldn't be able to come up with these know-how on their own again. And more importantly, perhaps, if that were the case, they should also be able to copy novel know-how when you give it to them. But again, they don't, right? So the only way that you can put these two data sets together is by coming up with the hypothesis, as we have done, that when or that the apes are basically stuck in a zone, in an area of potentially individually innovatable know-how. Within that zone, you know, of potentially innovatable know-how, they can be triggered, you know. To put a number to it, there will be a couple of thousands of these know-hows that apes have potentially available, right? And each individual population then hones into a subset of these, right? And these subsets will differ between these populations, but they all draw from this kind of zone of individually reachable know-how, right? It's a little bit of an odd way of thinking about it. I agree, you know, for me it was also hard to accept that, but that is simply the best hypothesis given all the available evidence that we have, you know. That really seems to be the case in the apes. And if I may, I see we have got a couple of minutes, if I may add to that, we recently then checked if perhaps another pattern that wouldn't fit with this story exists. Namely, if you were to find know-how that is restricted to only certain populations of apes, right? Similar to, say, languages that evolve, and then they are really specific to this population here, right? So if that were the case, well, then maybe we are wrong, right? Maybe then they do culturally transmit the know-how after all, and then over time they culturally evolve the know-how after all too. But what we found is that many people have claimed that that is the case. We found over 100 claims for know-how in apes where people have said, yes, they only do this here. But actually, when you check, when you ask around, did you guys see this in your population? You know, when you also go into the literature that came later and so on, you find that no, these things reappear elsewhere too. So it really seems to be the case that when the populations end up doing whatever they are doing, they are drawing from this bigger set of behaviors, but where all of these behaviors are potential individually innovatable behaviors, right? It is not the case that they locally culturally evolve the know-how and then they become locally super specific, you know? That doesn't seem to be the case. So this is the last bit of the puzzle that we recently published that was with Alba Montes Rodrigo. We call it the method of local restriction, and we show, you know, unlike the human case, we don't find these kind of patterns. Not really. Found three tentative cases, but they are probably false positives. So we don't find these kind of patterns in the ape cultural case, but we find it all of the time in the human case, you know.
And how important are things like teaching and curiosity for cumulative culture?
So curiosity would be linked to a motivation to find out new things, to create new things. But curiosity on its own cannot produce on its own the kind of cumulative culture that we have here. Because in addition, you need to have this ability to copy the know-how from others. Imagine we could magically make one chimpanzee super curious, like super, super curious, you know, and that chimpanzee would then build up all kinds of things. Well, if the others cannot ever copy novel know-how, it would lead nowhere, right? So the big difference maker, I would argue, the main difference maker, and I'm always interested in the main difference makers. For example, you have later on, now in modern humans, you have got other things too, joint attention, theory of mind, highly developed. Well, first of all, they are also partly cultural products. That's the first problem, right? But the second problem, I would argue that they are not like the first movers, right? I'm always interested in what is the first mover? How do you even get from A to B, right? And I personally have identified this to be this novel know-how copying. Maybe others would identify other things, you know, but that's what motivates me. So that's about the curiosity. But your question had a different part. Can you repeat it, please?
Yes, I asked also about teaching.
The teaching, good. Teaching, there has been a key paper that came out by Will Hoppit many years ago. And it's a brilliant paper. It very clearly told people of another misunderstanding. And it cleared that up. I wish that paper would be more widely known. You know, so it's Hoppit et al. I'm not completely sure. 2007, maybe, I'm not sure. But what it basically showed is that it took the definition of teaching, and the definition of teaching is basically social learning, but now the demonstrator is really could be called a demonstrator because the model becomes a teacher, right? So the model becomes a teacher by becoming active in the social learning part. That's basically all there is to teaching. So far in this interview, we have not been talking about teaching. Basically, observers see something and they could or could not copy, whatever, you know, but that would be the normal spiel. In teaching, now the model becomes active in some way. But what Will Hoppit and colleagues have then done is they have said, but we must not forget that there are so many different social learning mechanisms around, or as I would say, that there are different types of information that can be transmitted. We talked about the know where and the be case, you know, the know what and the termite case and so on. So we need to therefore distinguish teaching by the social learning mechanisms or by the types of information that are being transmitted. And seen in this way, if you have, for example, teaching of know what, as in maggots, you know, what are actually the kind of things that you need to eat, you know, the scorpions and so on. Well, then that's different from teaching of know-how. Or if the very few instances where people have said there is teaching in chimpanzees, for example, the best case is probably by Stefanie Musgrave and colleagues, where they have got some, I think, termite nest fishing with some sticks and so on, and there is some teaching going on. Fine, I'm okay-ish with that. But the teaching is not of a know-how. It's not that the mother is, you know, showing exactly how it's done, or would be an even better case that the mother is molding the hands of the youngsters. This is how it's done. Blah blah. No. What the kind of teaching that's going on here is the teaching of know what, namely the stick. The youngsters get the stick, right? The youngsters want, and the youngsters get the stick. It's a cost to the mother, so it's, you can call it teaching, fine, but it's teaching of know what, namely the stick, not of know how. And so the teaching needs to be broken up, and then when we look at it this way, we see that there is no teaching of know how in the apes. We can say that for certain when we are talking about the teaching of novel know-how, you know, the kind of know-how that you really have to have this course of copying for, there is none of that. And so teaching is not the kind of thing that helps apes produce a culture like ours. No, that kind of teaching of novel know-how is missing in the other apes. And also we need to find it in the hominins, you know. So and all our research so far is pointing to it arriving novel know-how copying, be it via teaching or just novel know-how copying, that it arrived quite late. You know, the archaeologists have often said within the last 3 million years or maybe within the last 2 million years. I would say probably within the last 500,000 years.
One last question then. Can science itself be understood from a cultural evolutionary perspective?
I think so too. Yes, I think so. And there are now many people who do meta science, right? And we see that the kind of tools that we have been using for a long time, for example, in comparative and developmental psychology, that these tools were quite bad, and that they have produced a lot of, well, let me be blunt about it, a lot of bullshit. And this is the best way to see that is by way of seeing that there is this replication crisis, meaning that people have produced data that is basically meaningless at best, but in many cases was misleading because it actually does not replicate. And this is another problem that we didn't even talk about, right? But there is also some noise in the literature, also in my field, that makes it also hard to see the bigger picture. But we don't have a full handle on it yet. Actually, last week, I think, came out a book chapter in which I was by far not the main author there, but I was some author in the middle there, where we talk about replication, potential replication crisis also coming to primatology. So these kind of things we really need to watch in the future, and we really need to pull everything together in order to better and culturally evolve our scientific tools, because without it, we will lead ourselves astray. You know, we will lead ourselves into all kinds of ways and pathways where we really shouldn't go, because that's all bullshit, you know.
Very well. So, Dr. Tenye, where can people find you and your work on the internet?
If you Google my name, you will find probably my Google Scholar page. That's the most up-to-date list of publications. I try to give a little spiel on my website, which you can also find by Googling me. It's a Google site. I try to bring together these kind of things there, but I'm a bit behind. I think the most up-to-date things can be found on my Twitter account. So that's at C Tenure. And there is where I try to have little blips, little Twitter threads about our most recent publications to try to make them more understandable, as it were. And there, if you go there, the very first tweet, it's a pinned tweet, has a Substack of all these different Twitter threads of the recent papers. So I think that way would be a very fast introduction to our kind of work.
Great. So thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
It's been a real pleasure too. Thank you for all these great work and the underlying questions. They really make you think. Thank you so much.
Okay, so let's. Hi guys, thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing and to help me keep the channel sustainable, please visit my Patreon page or PayPal and consider making a pledge there. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share the interview, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per Hugo Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alec, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arnaud Wolf, Tim Hollis, Henrik Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windega, Rui Inácio, Arthur Koh, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Colombo, Jorge Espinha, Phil Cabana, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreff, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Kusson, Jevan Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Liebrandt, Özlem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, JW, João Eira, Tom Hamel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Deza Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dermity Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevski, Nelek Bak, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Afzal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litzke, Denise Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, and Todd Shackelford. My producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafinia, Kian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardas France, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder. And my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Codriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.